Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
America in the age of Trump. Its leadership questioned, its values in doubt. I asked former Republican Senator and Secretary of Defense William Cohen about this presidency and America's standing in the world. Plus,
I'm afraid I just need to say this. The institution seems to be suffering from some kind of a collective learning disability.
Police under scrutiny. Seattle's former chief Norm Stamper tells our Michelle Martin about remorse and the reckoning. Then, from the other side, we look at the psychology and science of protest with Professor Clifford Stott, who advises the British government.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. Events shape presidencies as much as presidents shape events. Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci warns of a disturbing coronavirus surge in parts of the United States that calls for more, not less, testing. And now this double pandemic of the health crisis and racism has struck Donald Trump's administration in ways few of his immediate predecessors have experienced. And yet, the damage is mostly self-inflicted, according to his former national security advisor, John Bolton, whose tell-all memoir, The Room Where It Happened, Trump tried to ban, but now hits the shelves today. It is a damning account of a presidency that's described as corrupt, self-interested, and incompetent from someone who had a front row seat to the action, and where foreign policy seems dictated by the president's obsession with his re-election, perhaps at the cost of America's long-term interests. So, once the dust settles, what will America and its relationship with the rest of the world look like? To answer that question, my first guest tonight also sat in the room where it happened, only under a different presidency. William Cohen was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense and a Republican senator from Maine for nearly two decades before that. And he's joining me now from Bethesda, Maryland. Secretary Cohen, welcome back to the program. Let me ask you, because there's some really hair-raising stories described by John Bolton about his time as national security advisor, whether it's about President Trump allegedly seeking help in his re-election from, you know, the Chinese president, whether it's about potentially criminalizing dissent at home. What do you, I guess, you know, you've been on the cutting edge of foreign policy for so long. What do you see and what do you expect if there was to be a second Trump administration?
If that were to take place, then I think we would not recognize America as a democracy. I think President Trump is taking us down the road to tyranny, to one-man rule, to try and replicate what he sees as a positive in Moscow with President Putin. Or in Turkey with President Erdogan, or over in China or North Korea. I think he wants to have one-man rule, and it's not the rule of law, but just the opposite. It's the law of rule, where he only can make decisions. And he said quite publicly on multiple occasions, I'm above the law. The law doesn't apply to me. I'm the chief law enforcement officer. I am the commander-in-chief. Nothing I do is illegal because I do it. And so if you take away an obligation to run for re-election, now he has absolute authority to do whatever he wants because he feels he's not even bound by the law. And so I see a very dictatorial, absolutist type of rule in the country. And again, I don't think we'll be a democracy at that point.
Okay, so that is really dramatic. You don't think America will be a democracy. He's leading us down the road to tyranny. One man rule is what you've just said. I guess I want to ask you, but I almost know the answer. Are the institutions in America not strong enough to prevent that? But of course, that comes in the wake of the attorney general, you know, firing a U.S. attorney in New York. It comes in the wake of these, of the Republican Senate, basically all the time dancing to President Trump's tune. But is there a limit that you think that the institutions will no longer tolerate? For instance, the military stood up and said no to what was happening. You know, you remember, of course, with the photo op and clearing the peaceful American protesters from outside the White House.
Well, he is doing his best to really tear down these institutions, to politicize them in a way that they bend to his rule. He's tried to politicize the Justice Department. He has, in fact, politicized the Attorney General's office. He's tried to politicize the judiciary. He hasn't done it yet. But you may recall he likes to call the judiciary my judges. He wants to call the military my generals. And so he has done his best to delegitimize those institutions. They're holding for now. But as you can see, with Attorney General Barr simply intervening in cases involving the president's friend, I'm going to seek to drop the charges against Flynn. I'm going to reduce the charges against Stone. He is very actively involved in sending the signal that if you're my friend, you'll be protected. If you're my enemy, I'll prosecute you. So the institutions have been holding, but given four more years of the same thing, I doubt if they'll be able to withstand the pressure. The media has been attacked as the enemy of the people. And so now journalists are subject to being attacked, that they sometimes have to have escorts, armed escorts as such, to get from their home to the place of work. We're seeing people who are harassed for expressing personal opinions, threatening their lives and that of their families. So I think four more years of this type of lawlessness, then I think we will all have to reexamine what it means to be in a, quote, democracy that is run by someone who doesn't believe in the rule of law.
You are a Republican, as far as I know. Do you talk to your Republican colleagues, your former colleagues from when you were in Congress or the current ones? I mean, do you raise that alarm?
Well, I raise it publicly on every chance that I get by appearing on your show and others. I've talked to several of my former colleagues, and frankly, they don't recognize the Senate we once served in. And I know that everybody looks back over their shoulder and say those were the good old days. But for me, they were the good old days. You had people like Warren Rudman and Jack Danforth and Howard Baker and Al Simpson and so many others, Jack Javits. It was a Senate, a Republican Senate, that was Bob Dole, John McCain, Chuck Hagel. You go through the list of people who were open. It was a big tent. There was room for all of us to vent and ventilate our ideas. That no longer is the case. They're in lockstep for the most part with the president, and he rules by fear. If they vote against him or in any way indicate they don't favor what he is saying, then he puts out a tweet and suddenly they're in trouble back home with threats to their reelection potential, but also threats to them physically. So this is a different place than the Senate I served in. And again, maybe every former senator likes to say it was better then, but I have to believe that it was better then when we could reach across the aisle, we could reach compromise, we could dine with each other, we could share weekends with each other. I could write books with a Democrat and not be seen as being a traitor to the party. And that sentiment of looking at the other party and the other senators as enemies and not as colleagues, endeavoring to try to make the country better than it is, I think it's more difficult these days than it ever has been in the past.
And just briefly, one of your successors in Maine, obviously, is Senator Susan Collins. And of course, a lot of people, I don't know, try to say that she's a moderating influence or whatever, and there's a lot of sort of tightrope walking from her. And usually when push comes to shove, she sides with the president, usually. Do you talk to her?
I haven't talked to her. She has my number, and we're friends. And so I try not to intervene. I don't call members on the Hill. I don't try to persuade anybody. I'm not a lobbyist. If someone has a question, they can call me. Susan has a difficult race. There are two Maines. There's the rural conservative Maine, and there's the more liberal, quote, urban areas of Maine that she'll have to contend and balance that. In the end, I believe she'll do what she thinks is right. But she's going to have a tougher race than she's had in the past. I would say she still has, I think the odds are winning, but I think they're much tougher than she's ever faced in the past.
I guess I was just asking because you raise what appear to be certainly existential crises here, existential issues for the survival of the United States as a democracy as we know it. But I want to ask you, because this follows, these excerpts or the book now that's on the shelves by John Bolton has some pretty, from I guess many people's perspective, worrying accounts of President Trump being, quote unquote, well, my quote unquote, in hoc to authoritarian leaders who are not only authoritarian, but adversarial. China, for instance, the idea that he would have asked China to buy American farm products to help with his reelection, to give the so-called green light to interring China's Muslim population, the Uyghurs, in those internment camps. We talked about the firing of Jeffrey Berman, who was also apparently looking into a case concerning the Turkish National Bank, which we understand President Trump said to President Erdogan, well, when I have my people in place, you know, we'll fix it for you. Is there an IOU that these leaders will one day come asking Trump for in a second term? Or is the American president too strong to be IOU'd, so to speak?
I guess the question for me is, why are we surprised? We knew this about Donald Trump before he was elected. We knew when he was arranging for payments to Stormy Daniels. Back when I was in Congress and the House of Representatives, Spiro Agnew was removed from the vice presidency because he was taking kickbacks that he had arranged while he was governor of Maryland. He was actually taking money while he was sitting in the vice president's office. President Trump was sending money while he's in the president's office to Michael Cohen to pay off Stormy Daniels. So we knew this from the beginning, so it's not shocking. And when he asked Russia, are you listening? Can you hear me? Can you help me out here? And he's saying the same thing publicly. And he thinks because he's saying it publicly to China, will you help me out, that it's not inappropriate or bad or criminal. The notion that you would invite a foreign power to help you out in your election automatically creates a quid pro quo. Everything to him is a transaction. When he said that, look, I gave Jim Mattis, what did I do? I gave him $700 billion. What did he give me? Hello? He didn't give anything to you but 40 years of service of putting his life on the line. It's not a transaction where you give him money. By the way, it's not your money. It's the American people's money. So I'm not surprised that he's turned to others, help me out. He has taxed the American people. Tariffs are taxes. Whatever he says that the Chinese are paying, they're not paying. Every importer of Chinese goods is paying a tax called a tariff. And that tax they pass on to the consumer. So just as the American people are building the wall on the Mexican border, we're also paying the tax that's supposed to be paid by China. And yet he's been able to get away with that and then says, oh, by the way, I'll create an $18, $20 billion little fund over here for the farmers. If that isn't a direct form of corruption, I don't know what is. So I am not surprised by Bolton's revelations. They simply confirm what I believed was well evident before the election ever took place. And it's out there now. Unfortunately, he has people who just don't care. My hope is that there are enough people who do care about the rule of law, who know that that is the glue that holds a civilization together. And once you have the president who says the law doesn't apply to me, then everybody thinks, well, it doesn't apply to me either. So if he doesn't wear a mask, why should I? If he doesn't social distance, why should I? If he's able to say these crude, willful untruths, why can't I? Why can't I just submit all of these kooky, conspiracy ideas, send them out over the internet, and have the president retweet them? and take it as truth. So I think we've got to come to a reckoning. We talk about the Confederate flag coming down. Some of his supporters have had three flags. They have the American flag, the Confederate flag, and the Nazi flag. And I don't hear him condemning those who put the swastika on their arms. All I heard him say was there were good people in that group of neo-fascists, neo-Nazis. There were no good neo-Nazis. And yet he continues to give them comfort and support by not criticizing them, as opposed to looking at black people and say they're all thugs. They're all thugs and criminals. And Colin Kaepernick should be thrown out of the country or locked up and never again play football. We're taking a knee for justice. And he supports somebody who puts a knee on the neck of George Floyd. So I think there has to be a reckoning. And basically, I'm delighted to see the support that white people, like me, who are speaking out against what is taking place in this country of systemic racism that is so deeply embedded in our society that we don't even recognize it until people come out and they rebel against the system, saying, look what you have done to us. You continue to put your foot on our neck day in and day out, and we can't take it anymore. We can't breathe anymore. So now I think it's up to us white people to join hands with all of the minorities and say, we now recognize what we have been doing for the past four centuries. We've kept our knee on your neck, and now we got to get it off. And so I am delighted to see the people in the street, especially white people in the street, because it won't happen without us, because we're the ones who have the instruments of power, and we have had them all along. We have done everything in our power to subordinate, to subjugate, and to keep our knee on people of color because we regarded them as less than equal to us. And so the time has come for an awakening of what we have done and what we need to do to be a better America and a better world.
So I really hear your passion and your protective nature about the institutions of the United States and what needs to happen next. Obviously, voting and the presidential election is going to be a big deal. Do you believe that this is going to go ahead fine, that there's going to be an election? Because clearly, everything that you've just been passionately calling for could presumably only happen in a change of administration.
I don't think it'll be fair. I think the Republicans will do everything in their power to suppress the vote. We're seeing it take place now. It's taking place today in Kentucky. They have one polling place for the whole state. I mean, this is ludicrous. And we're seeing them shut down from 100 polling places to 4 or 5 in other states. So that's number one. Number two, the president is out degrading the notion of paper write-in ballots. And so he said, go out there and stand in line during the COVID crisis, as long as necessary, 8 hours, 10 hours, doesn't matter. And if you are writing in your ballots, they're automatic, in my judgment, they're fraudulent. So I think he's already calling into question the authenticity, the legitimacy of the vote before it's ever taken. And so I think that he's putting in the soil, he's seeding the soil with these poisonous weeds to say, no matter what happens, I'm going to declare this election invalid. I'm going to stay here till we have a recount. I'm going to force a recount. I don't think he'll accept the results, assuming that he loses. And again, that's a big assumption because I think they'll do everything they can to suppress the vote in those states and those areas where minorities are strongest.
Well, Secretary William Cohen, you've certainly put us all on notice. Remember, I'm just going to say it again, you are a Republican talking about this Republican administration and this Republican president. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, of course, actions of law enforcement are under scrutiny, of course, like never before in the United States, as we've been discussing. Just yesterday, police in Washington used pepper spray to break up anti-racism protesters who tried to topple a statue of President Andrew Jackson, a dyed-in-the-wool nationalist and a slave owner. Our next guest was a cop for 34 years, and he spent 6 of them as Seattle's police chief. Norm Stamper resigned, though, over his handling of the 1999 World Trade Organization protests after he authorized the use of tear gas. Ever since, Stamper has been a vocal advocate for police reform. And here he tells our Michelle Martin how he became part of what he calls the dark side of police culture and how to fix that problem.
Thanks, Christian. Chief Stamper, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Chief, you were a police officer for 34 years, the first 28 in San Diego, the last six in Seattle as the chief of police. But do you mind just walking us back and say, why were you attracted to law enforcement to begin with?
I became a cop accidentally. I had a friend who was taking a civil service test at the War Memorial Building in Balboa Park in San Diego, and he asked me if I wanted to accompany him. At the time, I was a veterinary assistant at a small pet hospital and playing rhythm and blues at night. I passed the test. He didn't. And he was one of those people who wanted to be a cop since he was three. I had kind of uneasy, if not unpleasant, experiences with the police. Was not really much of a fan at age 20 when I took the test. But I passed it and then got sucked into the culture very, very quickly. And learned an awful lot about the institution over the years.
So, Chief, when you say you got sucked into the culture, what do you mean by that?
Well, at the time that I became a police officer, it was with the idea that I was going to be different from the officers I had experienced in my young life, that I would not use excessive force. I would never use the N-word. I would never laugh at the cruel jokes that were told in the locker room or the front seat of a police car. But within 5 minutes, I'm doing almost all of that. I never did succumb to the temptation to use the N-word, but it was all around me. And it was something that within 5 minutes' time, figuratively speaking, I was saying and doing things that I'd never said, never done before. And I'm ashamed of those days. I wouldn't trade them for anything because I carry to this day a cellular memory of just how powerful that culture is.
Well, you were in it for three decades, so you must have liked it. So what is it that you liked about it?
The short answer is, for the first 14 months on the job, I was abusing the very people I had been hired to protect and serve. And then I got slapped upside the head by a principled prosecutor who asked me if the Constitution of the United States meant anything to me. Hmm. I was furious with him. I was the one that was out there on the mean streets, San Diego. I was out there during the heat and the cold, once again, San Diego. But I was in the real world, and he was prowling the hallways of the courthouse. And what gave him the right to judge me and the arrest that I had made? The arrest, by the way, was a false arrest. In other words, I had violated the law. I had violated the Constitution, and he wanted no part of that, and he told me so. I went from anger to embarrassment to shame in sort of a breathtakingly short period of time, and decided then and there, that's it. I am going to change, and I did.
So, Chief, you know, this is so interesting because one of the events for which you are known, in addition to being a kind of a thoughtful critic of this institution, is, but you're known for Seattle's response to the protests at the WTO, the World Trade Organization's Ministerial Conference in 1999, which led to your resignation, where you did use chemical agents. I mean, you did all the things that you criticize people for doing. So can you just talk a little bit about that? I'm sure it's very complicated, and I'm sure, you know, it was a long time ago, but you did.
It is a little complicated, but let's simplify it. I authorized the use of chemical agents against my fellow Americans, non-violent, indeed non-threatening protesters who had decided to take a seat in the middle of an intersection that we believed, from the police point of view, was important to us and to public safety. And so we used that tear gas after warning the protesters for about a half an hour. For 5 years into my retirement, Michelle, I am still defending that position. I am talking around the country and throughout North America and Australia, as a matter of fact, and saying we didn't have a choice. We had to use chemical agents. that intersection was critical tactically and from a public safety point of view. That was the cop in me saying that. That was the cop in me that authorized the use of tear gas. The police chief in me, the organizational leader in me should have been saying, wait a minute, do we really need to use tear gas here? Did we really need that intersection at that moment? Could an ambulance or a fire truck, for example, been able to go a couple of blocks to the left or to the right, to the east or to the west? And the answer, of course, is yes. So this sort of black and white, single-minded mentality got me in trouble. It produced within me a rationalization that I clung to for about 5 years, as I said, into my retirement. And then I realized, oh my God, I am wrong. It was the worst decision, I think, of my career, certainly when it comes to tactics in protest situations, the absolute worst decision. I'm ashamed of the decision that I made. I have certainly learned from it. And I'm afraid, I just need to say this, the institution seems to be suffering from some kind of a collective learning disability. We presented in vivid terms a how to and a how not to police protests in this country in 1999. And yet over and over, city after city, we're seeing those same mistakes made. It's painful to watch. It's sad to watch.
Well, that leads us to the current moment. As you are seeing, you know, around the country now, there is a call now to defund the police. And what's interesting about this is that you're seeing legislatures take this up around the country, take it up seriously. Is that the right decision?
Yes, no, and maybe. Sound like a politician or a consultant, apologize for that. I think what's safe to conclude here is that whether it's a call for dismantling the police or defunding the police, we got to talk about it. It absolutely must be on the table. I'm a very strong supporter of that conversation, however painful it may be for the establishment, for civic leaders, for elected local officials, for police administrators, for police unions. It's time for us to get to that table and have an honest, probing conversation about why it is that policing lacks legitimacy in too many quarters throughout this country.
What would that look like? A radical rethinking of the way policing is done in this country. What would that look like?
I would start with a premise that in a theoretically a multicultural, free and democratic society, that we need to produce a grassroots model of police policymaking, police oversight. Every aspect of police operations should be a result of police community collaboration, authentic partnership, not some public relations cosmetic version thereof. I've seen a lot of incremental change. I've advocated, I've participated in organizational improvement efforts and strengthening community police relations. And all of that, I think, is highly suspect today because it has not produced the change that we desperately need in this country. So it's going to have to come, I'm convinced, from the community in a structured fashion that will make sure that community voices are heard and heeded. And so when we start throwing these terms around, the first order of business is to define them and to ask whether we've got the political will, the personal courage, because so much of this is going to be contested, so much of this is going to be fought, particularly by police unions, but to face the challenges, to face every single obstacle and dismantle it until we arrive at an authentic community police policymaking, decision-making, crisis management partnership.
Do you have any sympathy for some of these men and women on the street, though? I mean, particularly after 9/11, you know, they were told they were heroes. You know, you're heroes. I mean, you saw these posters, recruiting posters all over town. Be a hero, right? Be a guardian, be a hero. And yet, and now people are saying, get your knee off this man's neck. You people are killers. You know what I mean? I mean, it just seems as though, do you kind of see where for some people that's a head snap?
It is a head snap. I'm admitting it to you. It's a head snap for me because I did not believe that we would see the outpouring of anger at what that officer did back on May 25th in Minneapolis. An outpouring of anger from cops who have been silent or who have in fact opposed protest movements in the wake of Sandra Bland and Tamir Rice and on and on and on. So it's wonderful and it's heartening to see that. I really do believe that we are at a crossroads in policing, and that individual officers. Let's take an officer, for example, who is compassionate, who is understanding, who's empathetic, who listens to people, who genuinely believes in and practices de-escalation, and who has partnered with the citizens on his beat. That officer's reputation is currently being shaped by people like Derek Chauvin. And that's unspeakably sad to me because I know these cops who've done wonderful work. Now what's going to happen, I believe, I have to say that it's going to happen, is because people inside and outside the system are saying what we saw when that knee hit that neck and all of that officer's body weight was pressed against a fellow human being saying that he can't breathe for almost 9 minutes, so we're saying absolutely never again, never again. Well, we've seen it since. We will continue to see it until the system itself changes and recognizes the good work done by good cops and takes truly accountable action to prevent what we saw in Minneapolis, and certainly to hold accountable any and all individuals responsible for it.
Your book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police, was published in 2016, and then you, and that was your second book. I mean, you also, before that, you wrote Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. That was 2005. So I have two questions to you about this. Do you feel in a way that other people are coming around to where you already were?
Back in the 70s, when I was a sergeant in San Diego, I wrote a senior thesis at San Diego State University entitled The Community is DMZ, Breaking Down the Police Paramilitary Bureaucracy. So throughout my adult life, I have been an advocate of fundamental, radical change of the system of American policing. And yes, it is gratifying to hear the conversation today. At the same time, I'm asking myself why. You know, and no one individual, I don't care who that individual is, whether it is the President of the United States or a police sergeant in Waukegan, decides that they want to see change, they can, in that portion of their world, help bring about that change. But what's needed is some degree of unity, born not of blind loyalty to one idea or another, but rather to a clash of these ideas, till we get to the point at which we can see, yeah, I can see this working. I can
see. Okay, but this is where I go back to you. This is one of the things that fascinates me about you, and I'm not picking on you. But the reality is you study these things. Well, I mean, but you study these things for years. You have these instincts, as you tell us, from when you were a very young officer. I mean, really early in your career, you had these instincts. And yet when the time came for you to make a fundamental break with the way crowd control was done, you didn't do it. And so that's one of the reasons that I asked the question. And we constantly hear for years, for decades, we've been hearing about reform and better relationships. And yet when push comes to shove, we still see people putting their knees on somebody's neck, tasing them, shooting them after they were stopped for a DUI. why does it seem to not ever come, you know, move from the dissertation to practice on the streets? Why is that?
I'll give you the most honest answer I can, and that is that we are so conditioned to organizational life, to institutional life, as we've known it, as we've grown up in that system. See, when I grew up in the system, we were using tear gas as something that tactical experts would call a force multiplier. You don't have enough cops to clear an intersection, bring out the gas and apply liberally. That was a part of our central nervous system built into the DNA of the police paramilitary bureaucracy. And it's an incredibly strong, resilient bureaucracy. It's also toxic, and it is also amenable today to the kind of radical change that I have never believed possible until this moment, until so many eyes I get affected by this. Every time I see another image of Derek Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck, I get sick. It's almost a visceral thing. I realize this is horrific. An act of murder committed by somebody who wore a uniform similar to the one that I wore, who wears a uniform similar to all of those honest and good and compassionate cops out there. He has in effect been the symbol of law enforcement. And if that's acceptable to us, let's ride out this storm and go back to business as usual. I don't think, I know that it's not going to happen. I'm 76 years old. This is literally the first time in my adult life that I have felt optimistic about change. We're at a very raw, very, very tough moment, I think, in our history right now. But it's coming, and it could be a beautiful thing.
Chief Stamper, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, my next guest is Clifford Stott. He's an expert in the psychology of crowds, and he spent his career studying protests. He's advising the government here in the UK on how to reduce the risk of civil unrest in the wake of this pandemic. And he's joining me now from Liverpool. Professor Stott, welcome to the program. You just heard former Chief Stamper talk about the police side of this crisis and thinking that, you know, not just the pandemic, but the post-George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests and the movement on the streets could be a real tipping point. From your experience, before we get into the crowds, do you also share that optimism when it comes to police?
Yes, I suppose I do. It was a fascinating and powerful account from the chief there. Interesting that he had the epiphany moment 5 years after he left the organisation, but somebody who clearly understands the challenges of reforming police culture. And it's an ongoing struggle that has to grasp every opportunity that is delivered. And one of the things that I've learned about police reform is that it happens in the wake of crisis. It would be lovely to think that we could get to the point where police reform happens before the crisis to prevent the crisis happening in the first place. But nonetheless, this is a crisis, and within that lies an opportunity for change.
So I want to get so that we understand how you came to this position. What is it that moved you to start looking into not just police action, but also crowd and protest action, even football crowds and so-called, as we call them here in England, hooligans, their actions? What brought you to this place?
Well, I've always found crowds fascinating. When I was a young man, some considerable time ago now, I was attending lots of demonstrations that turned into violence. So I was interested in understanding that. I was politically aware, and I wanted to try to use science to understand the dynamics through which crowds turn from peaceful demonstrations into conflictual and violent riots. That was the PhD question that I did when I signed up to become a a doctor, and I studied that through going to crowd events and watching them transform, both in a political context, but also in a sporting context. So here in the UK, of course, football hooliganism has always been a very powerful issue. But that too is a crowd event, and within those crowds lies an understanding of the dynamics through which crowds transform. And what was interesting from my point of view was that we move away from this idea that crowds are places of irrationality to an understanding that crowds are very meaningful for people, and those meanings are shaped and reshaped through their interaction with the police during a crowd event. So the dynamics of crowd psychology are not just about the psychology of the crowd, but also the psychology of the police and their culture that we've just heard so powerfully about.
So I want to ask you, because a social scientist in 1985, Gustave Le Bon, wrote The Crowd, and in it he said, by the mere fact that he forms part of an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultivated individual. In a crowd, he is a barbarian. Is it as simple as that?
Well, it was slightly longer ago than 1985. It was actually 1895 that book was written. But strangely, those ideas, they're still with us. They're still contemporary. So it's perfectly appropriate to talk about them in the contemporary sense, because they've become so deeply rooted in how we think about crowd events that you even see them in the headlines in newspapers about the rioting that we've seen recently. But you capture very powerfully the way in which Le Bon's crowd psychology renders the crowd irrational, a place where ordinary people who can be law-abiding under most normal circumstances, when they enter a crowd, become anonymous. And through that anonymity, there's some kind of breakdown in their psychological functioning. And where that happens, then the crowd becomes uncivilized, irrational, malleable, dangerous. And it flows into not just our understanding of how crowds operate, but also how we manage them. And that's why people often refer to the concept of crowd control, because it implies that crowds are things that need to be controlled because of their inherent irrationality.
So, you know, in all the reading, you know, on the psychology of riots, for instance, some people say why it is never just mindless violence. So I want to ask you about making a distinction between protest, between violent elements, where, but you know, you have protests in the United States, Europe, all over the world, right here in England now, because of what happened in America and the George Floyd Black Lives Matter movement. And yet you've got leaders, both here in the UK and in the US, calling them thugs, calling them radicals. Can you break down what you see on the streets and how it should be policed?
Well, firstly, we need to move away from the Le Bonian idea of irrationality and recognize that crowd action or collective action in a crowd is driven by meaning and understanding. And then we can ask the question, well, where do those meanings come from? And those meanings are often revolved around a sense of legitimacy or fairness and injustice. So when we ask why are people mobilizing onto the streets, they mobilize onto the streets for two primary reasons at the moment in America. One is the death of George Floyd in a particular incident, but also the extent to which that particular incident captures a broader structural inequality of the day-to-day interactions between large sections of the American population and the police force that is there to serve them. And in that experience is a sense of injustice that drives an identity through which people mobilize out onto the streets into a social movement to confront that injustice. So for people involved, it's highly meaningful for them, and to render it irrational denies us the opportunity to understand where that psychology comes from. And indeed, that's precisely why that psychology, that Le Bonian psychology, is so popular, because it does precisely that. It prevents governments having to ask questions. It prevents police forces having to ask questions about their own role in the production of that violence.
So what should police be doing? Because we've seen in the United States, even after these terrible police killings, still a sort of a militarized police confronting peaceful protesters by and large. And we saw it in 2011 here in London after the killing of Michael Duggan here in London. Maybe the rest of our viewers won't remember, but London and England kind of burned for several days. And you studied that quite intensely. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from that? What should police do? What chances and opportunities did they miss?
Well, again, I would just refer back to the last interview to some extent that we heard from the horse's mouth, as it were, from the commander of the policing operation in Seattle about what went wrong from his point of view. This reliance on an overly militarized, repressive style of policing. And that for him, the solution was about what he called community policing. Now, community policing is policing from within the communities, from within the neighborhoods, built around dialogue and communication. And to a large extent, that's what goes wrong. That's what went wrong in 2011 in two respects. One is that when Mark Duggan was shot, it was over 48 hours from that shooting to the first conflicts. And within that, the Metropolitan Police Service themselves recognised that the core failure was a failure of dialogue and communication. But also that on the day-to-day interactions, a heavy program of stop and search, or what Americans call stop and frisk, was creating tensions between black youth and the police that flowed into the situation outside Tottenham Police Station after these failures in dialogue, and led to an escalation when the police intervened after there was an attack on a police car. So there's a whole series of dynamics that come together. But the most important lesson is communication. Communication, dialogue, and neighbourhood policing is the solution to these kinds of conflicts.
So we've seen polls in the United States, and pollsters have said polls have shifted after George Floyd faster than they've ever seen in any social or political issue in the past. So on May 29th, apparently 59% told the Wall Street Journal that they were more troubled by the actions of the police than of Black Lives Matter protests, even those that turned violent. So what can police do now? What should they do? You advise a lot of police departments. You advise the government here, in how to crowd control and properly police. What can one do to bring the police back from this brink, particularly in the time that people are talking about defunding the police and all the rest of it?
Well, it's a broader political challenge here. The solutions don't just lie with the police. This is not just a policing problem, it's a political one too. We have the right kind of political leadership in place for a start. But there, where we can work with the police, what we try to do is to create what we call knowledge-based policing, to first and foremost help them to understand the dynamics of crowds, because often what police are doing is making decisions based on an inaccurate understanding of crowd psychology and the dynamics through which violence comes about. And that's a big problem. So if we can get into a situation where we can reform policy, and then that we can work with police educators to help inform police officers and police commanders in particular about the dynamics of crowds, that's a good start. The second thing is to then focus on the development of tactics. So what we see in the context of policing crowds is a massive over-reliance on military styles of intervention. It's all about equipment, helmets, batons, water cannon, gas, all the kinds of things that this militarized approach has inherent within it. And there is very little emphasis on tactical capability for communication. So in countries like Sweden, for example, where we work with the police extensively, they developed specialized units of dialogue police who are trained negotiators who understand how to use communication to de-escalate escalate, to navigate the dynamics of power in a crowd event. And where we see that tactical capability combined with a strategic framework that's based on an accurate understanding of crowd dynamics and behavior, then we start to see reductions in conflict. And we see that pattern across the world. This is supported by scientific research and theory. So the opportunity is there for the police to embrace it. So the question is, why don't they? And this is really then about the professionalisation of the police, building a police force that is prepared to embrace scientific knowledge and theory.
It's really a challenge. I'm sure your services will be much in demand because we're right at the coalface of this massively important debate. Clifford Stott, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, as lockdown restrictions here in England continue to be eased, from July 4th, pubs, hairdressers, hotels and even restaurants will be allowed to reopen. But long before coronavirus, epidemics have been reshaping our cities across the world and indeed how they work. London sewers, for instance, were built after a cholera outbreak in the 19th century. Many of New York's large parks, like Central Park, were planned after epidemics to provide more open spaces. Today, cities around the world are reimagining their streets in an effort to transform the way people get around in a new socially distanced world, also paying attention to the climate. Our Nick Robertson is finding out much more on the streets right now.
Our cities everywhere are changing. They're getting breathing space, quite literally. Here in London, more space for cyclists and for pedestrians, less for cars. A new world made for social distancing.
It's a win-win situation. It's a win for the pedestrian. It's a win-win for two wheels. It's a win-win for the drivers. So let's see what's going to happen.
COVID-19 is causing cities across the globe to adapt in similar ways, from Paris to Bogota, from New York to Buenos Aires. But will the transformation last forever?
Here in London, if we have, there are probably 8 million journeys that need to be made by other modes. If a fraction of those end up on our in cars on our roads, we're going to end up with gridlock, which is exactly why we need to enable people to take those cleaner, greener, more sustainable journeys now. And I hope that as they get used to it, that's behaviour that sticks.
A quick mid-morning journey on London's previously overstuffed underground, wearing a now mandatory face covering, a rapid reminder of how strange the world of confined spaces now feels.
The question is, when the pandemic recedes, will people go back to their old ways and cram onto crowded public transport again?
To help answer that, I asked John Dale, who designs people-friendly streets. We meet at one of London's highly touted new bike lanes.
Take what is currently these bus stops, move the bus stops out, possibly make this a cycle lane. There's no need for more walking space probably here, but you can see over there there's hatch, basically where you can see the hatching,
space. That's wasted space.
Authorities are cutting planning time and investing. The British government has set aside $300 million. But this being London, not everyone is happy.
Well, it just won't work. London have come to a standstill.
Roy has been a cabbie 40 years. Seen it all, he says.
It's just a novelty, like, shut the roads off, have a bike day and everyone's out there. You know, it's not Amsterdam, it's just London, a busy city.
What the local authority have done is put these in the road to stop cars being able to drive through the road.
Matt Winfield runs a national organisation keeping cyclists and pedestrians safe.
When there are no cars or few cars on the road and people feel comfortable, they'll cycle in huge number. So hundreds and thousands of people across the country have had the experience of cycling in a really present environment, and we need to kind of make sure that sort of change in behaviour is locked in.
As he talks, a lady calls for our attention. She has bad asthma, has been sheltering in place, windows shut until the traffic blocked.
It's lowered the pollution. I can open my window right now.
There seems to be an acceptance that change is necessary in a variety of different ways. We've accepted it for this emergency. We still seem a little nervous, broadly speaking, to accept that there's a climate emergency as well. But the fact that it can be different is something we are all seeing.
what to do is going to be a decision coming to all of us soon enough.
Ultimately, governments want us back at work, and soon. But as long as public transport remains problematic, then we have to change our travel habits.
London, like so many other cities across the world, is at a potential turning point.
For me, I can stay there forever. I can have more bylines all over the place, mate. I'll be happy with that. See ya.
Nick Robertson, CNN, London.
And join us tomorrow when we'll be examining the challenges and opportunities to protecting the environment in the post-pandemic era. Finally, the Barcelona Opera House has reopened its doors, not to people, of course, but to an audience of more than 2,000 potted plants. The leafy spectators were serenaded by a string quartet playing Chrysanthemi by the Italian composer Puccini. The show is the brainchild of the Spanish artist Eugenio Ampudia, who was inspired by the revival of nature during this pandemic, which was reclaiming spaces that were once belonging to them. The plants will be donated to frontline healthcare workers as a thank you for their hard work in recent months. And so we leave you with the quartet's inspiring piece. Thank you for watching, and join us again tomorrow night.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.